what with the economic crisis and climate change. Laura worked there in a restaurant built in the style of an alpine lodge, near to where the ski lifts began, and as fake in its way as the artificial snow on the pistes. She came forward to embrace me wearing the apron of a waitress, and with a smile that could not conceal how tired she was. She was young, Laura. She was no more than 30, but for a good while now she had been living the life of an older woman, and it showed. There were few skiers about, so she asked one of her colleagues to cover for her and came to sit at a table with me. While talking, she showed me a photo of Anita, a blonde, rather frail, smiling child who was hugging a black dog much bigger than herself. She told me that she was in her first year of school. It was difficult to convince her to conform to certain rules. When she started, she was like some kind of feral child. She would get in a fight with someone, or would begin to scream, or would sit in a corner the whole day saying nothing. Now, little by little, perhaps she was becoming civilized. Laura laughed. She said, "But the thing she likes most is when I take her to some farm. There she feels at home. She lets the calves lick her hands, you know, with that rough tongue of theirs, and she isn't afraid at all. And it's the same with goats and with horses. She's happy with every kind of animal. I hope that won't change and that she'll never forget it." She stopped to sip some of her tea. I saw that her fingers around the cup were red, her nails bitten down to the quick. She looked around the restaurant and said, "You know, I also worked here when I was 16, all winter, Saturdays and Sundays, while my friends went skiing. How I hated them." "It's not such a bad place," I said. "Oh, yes, it is. I never thought I'd come back here, but as they say, sometimes you have to take a step backwards in order to move forwards. That is, if you have the humility to admit it to yourself." Now she was referring to Bruno. As soon as we got onto the subject, she came down hard on him. She told me that 2 or 3 years previously, when it was clear that the farm was not viable, they still would have been able to find solutions. Sell the cows, rent out the farmstead, both look for jobs. Bruno would have been quickly taken on at a building site or dairy processing unit, or even on the ski slopes. She could have worked as a shop assistant or waitress. She was ready to make this choice, to lead a more ordinary life until the situation improved. Bruno, on the other hand, did not want to know about it. In his mind, there was no possibility of alternative lives. At a certain point, she realized that neither she nor Anita, nor what she had believed they were building up there together, were as important as his precious mountain, whatever that really meant to him. The moment she realized this, the relationship was over for her. From the very next day, she had begun to imagine a future far away from there, with her little girl, but without him. She said, "Sometimes love exhausts itself gradually, and sometimes it comes to an end suddenly. Isn't that how it goes?" "Well, I don't know anything about love," I replied. "Oh, right. I'd forgotten." "I went to see him. He's up at Barma now. He wants to stay there. He's not coming down." "I know," said Laura. "The last of the mountain men." "I don't know how to help him." "Forget it. You can't help someone who doesn't want to be helped. Leave him there where he wants to be." Saying this, she glanced at her watch, exchanged a look with her colleague at the counter, and got up to go back to work. Laura the waitress. I remembered when she used to guard the cows beneath the rain, proud, still, with her black umbrella. "Say hello to Anita for me," I said. "Come and see her before she's 20," she said, and then she embraced me a little more tightly than before. There was something in that embrace that her words had not communicated, emotional turmoil perhaps, or nostalgia. I left as the first skiers were arriving for lunch, with their helmets and their all-in-one suits and their plastic boots, looking like aliens. The snow began falling suddenly and heavily at the end of December. On Christmas Day, it snowed even in Milan. After lunch, I was looking out of the window onto the avenue of my childhood with a few cars passing gingerly along it and one skidding at the traffic lights and coming to a halt in the middle of the crossing. There were children throwing snowballs, Egyptian children who had perhaps never seen snow before. In 4 days' time, I would be catching the plane that would take me back to Kathmandu. But I wasn't thinking about Nepal now. I was thinking about Bruno. I felt like I was the only one who knew that he was up there. My mother came to be next to me at the window. She had invited her friends to lunch, and they were chatting tipsily at the table, waiting for dessert. There was a joyful atmosphere in the house. There was the nativity scene that she set up every year with the moss she collected at Grana, the red tablecloth, wine, and good company. I envied once more her talent for friendship. She had no intention of growing old, sad, and alone. She said, "In my opinion, you should try again." "I know," I replied, "but I don't know if it will make any difference." I opened the window and stretched my hand outside. I waited for a snowflake to land on my hand. It was heavy and wet and melted instantly on contact with my skin. But I wondered what it would be like now at 2,000 meters. So the next day I bought some snow chains on the motorway and a pair of snowshoes in the first shop in the valley, and joined the queues of cars that were going up from Milan and Turin. Almost all of them had skis on their roof racks. After recent seasons without much snow, the skiers were rushing to the mountains as if to the reopening of an amusement park. Not one of them took the turning at the junction for Grana. After just a few bends, I stopped seeing anyone else. Then, when the road curved past the rock, I entered into my old world again. There was snow piled up against the stables and the log-built haylofts, snow on the tractors, on the tin roofs of shacks, on the wheelbarrows and piles of manure. Snow that filled the ruined buildings and almost completely concealed them. In the village, someone had cleared a narrow strip of road between the houses, perhaps the two men I saw on a roof throwing down the snow that had accumulated up there. They looked up, without deigning to acknowledge me. I left the car a little further on, where the snowplow had been stopped, or perhaps just given up, having cleared just enough space to turn around and head back. I put on gloves, since recently my fingers tended to freeze in the slightest cold. I fixed the snowshoes to my boots, climbed over the wall of hard snow that blocked the road, and went into the fresh snow beyond it. It took me more than 4 hours to cover the route that in summer would take fewer than 2. Even with the snowshoes, I was sinking almost knee-deep. I was finding my way only by remembering it, gauging the direction from the contours of bumps and slopes, from a still discernible passage between the snow-clad pines, without any track to follow, or any of my usual points of reference on the ground. The snow had buried the remains of the cable lift's winding gear, the ruined walls, the piles of stones quarried from the pastures, the stumps of centuries-old larch. All that remained of the river was a hollow between the two gently sloping humps of its banks. I crossed it at a randomly chosen point with a leap into fresh snow, falling forwards onto my hands without injury. On the other side, the incline became increasingly steep, and every 3 or 4 steps I would slip back, taking a small avalanche with me. Then I would have to use my hands as well, pointing the snowshoes as if they were crampons and trying again with more determination. Only on reaching Bruno's farmstead did I fully realize just how much snow had fallen. It had reached halfway up the windows of the stable. But the gusts of wind had swept the side facing the mountain, forming a tunnel a footstep wide, and I stopped there to get my breath back. The grass in that small strip of ground was dead and dry, gray as the stone walls. There was no light, and no other color but white, gray, and black. And the snow was continuing to fall. When I arrived at the top, I discovered that the lake had disappeared along with everything else. It was only a snow-filled basin, a gentle depression at the mountain's foot. And so, for the first time in many years, instead of going around it, I headed straight across in the direction of Barma. It seemed most strange, walking over so much water. I was halfway across when I heard someone calling.
"Oh!" I heard. "Berio!"
I raised my eyes and saw Bruno much higher up the slope, a small figure above the tree line. He waved, and as soon as I waved back, he threw himself down. Then I realized he must be wearing skis. He was coming down at an oblique angle, with his legs opened wide and without any style, just as he did when coming down the snowfields in the summer. He also held his arms open and his chest thrust forward, keeping a precarious balance. But in front of the first larch trees, I saw him throw himself to one side and steer decisively, avoiding the wood by crossing higher up, down to the main gorge of the Grenon, where he stopped. In the summer, a small stream flowed in that gorge, but now it was a broad, snow-filled slide that reached unobstructed all the way down to the lake. Bruno assessed the steepness of the incline over the distance remaining between us, then pointed his skis in my direction and set off again. In the gorge, he immediately picked up speed. I don't know what would have happened if he had fallen there, but he kept upright, swooped into the basin, and gradually braked on the flat, sliding to where I was and coming to a standstill. He was sweaty and smiling.
"Did you see that?"
he said, breathing heavily. He lifted one of the skis that must have been 30 or 40 years old and looked like some kind of military relic. He said,
"I went down to get a shovel and found these in my uncle's cellar. They've been there for years. I don't know who they belonged to."
"But when did you learn how to use them?"
"About a week ago. Do you know what's hardest? Not looking at a tree if you think you're about to collide with it. If you look, you're sure to hit it. Bullseye."
"You're crazy," I said. Bruno laughed and clapped me on the back. He had a long gray beard and his eyes were lit with euphoria. He must have lost some weight as his features were sharper than ever.
"Oh, Merry Christmas," he said, and then, "Come, come on."
As if we had met there by chance and needed to go and toast this fortunate coincidence. He picked up the skis and, carrying them on his back, cleared a path for me on the slope along a route that he must have known from his experiments as a skier. I almost felt compassion for our little house on the rock face when I saw it surrounded by walls of snow almost as high as itself. Bruno had cleared the roof and dug a trench around the house, which he'd widened into a small square in front of the door. When I went inside, it felt like entering into a burrow. It seemed welcoming and more cluttered and messier than before. The window was blind now. There was nothing to look out at but layers of white on the other side of the glass. And I had barely had time to take off my wet clothes and sit myself down at the table before something fell onto the tiles of the roof with a tremendous thud. I instinctively looked up, afraid that it was about to collapse on me. Bruno burst out laughing. He said,
"Did you fix the rotten ones properly that time? Now we'll see whether the roof holds, eh?"
The thuds continued, but he took no notice of them. When I, too, had got more used to them, I began to notice the changes that had been made to the room. Bruno had put up some more shelves by placing them on nails hammered into the walls, and had filled them with his books, clothes, and tools, giving to the place the air of something that it had never had before, that of a lived-in house. He poured 2 glasses of wine. He said to me,
"I've got to apologize. I'm sorry things went as they did last time. I'm glad that you've come back. I'd given up hope. We're still friends, right?"
"Of course," I said. While I started to relax, he rekindled the fire in the stove. He went outside with the bucket and brought it back filled with snow, then put it to melt to make the polenta with. He asked me if I felt like having a bit of meat for supper, and I told him that after that slog I would be happy to eat anything. So he took out pieces of chamois that he had cured in salt and put them in a pan with butter and wine. When the water in the pail reached a boiling point, he threw in a few handfuls of cornmeal. He took out another liter of red to keep us company while we waited, and after the first couple of glasses, as the room filled with the pungent smell of game, I began to feel good again too. Bruno said,
"I was angry, and what made me even angrier was that I had no one else to blame. The fact is that I made all the mistakes myself. Nobody led me into them. What was I thinking, trying to become a businessman? Someone like me who knows nothing about money. I should have fixed up a little place like this one, brought 4 cows up here, and lived like this from the start."
I kept quiet, listening to him. I understood that he had thought long and hard and had found the answers he had been looking for. He said,
"You have to do what life has taught you to do. Perhaps when you're still very young you can choose, maybe, to change the course of your life. But at a certain point you have to stop and say to yourself, 'Fine, this is what I'm capable of doing, and this is what I can't do.' This is what I asked myself, and the answer? I know how to live in the mountains. Put me up here by myself and I can cope. That's something, don't you think? But it took me until I was 40 years old to realize the value of it."
I was exhausted and was settling down into the warmth of the wine, and even though I would not have admitted it, I liked hearing him speak like this. There was something absolute about Bruno that had always fascinated me.
a certain integrity and purity that I had admired in him ever since we were boys. I was almost persuaded to believe him, up there in the little house that we had built together, that the best way of living his life was that one, alone in the middle of winter with nothing but a little food, left to his own devices and his own thoughts, even though it would have seemed inhuman for anyone else. It was the mountain itself that woke me from this fantasy. I heard a sound that was different from the usual thudding on the roof. It began like the roar of an airplane or like distant thunder, but then got immediately closer, deafening, a rumbling that shook the glasses on the table. We looked at each other, and I could see at that moment that he was no more prepared for this than I was, and no less terrified. To the rumbling, another sound was added, that of a crash, something colliding and exploding, and immediately after it, the sounds diminished in intensity. Then we began to realize that the avalanche could not have passed over us. It had passed nearby, but elsewhere. More material fell. We felt another, weaker fall. Then the silence returned just as suddenly as it had been broken. When everything had stopped moving, we went out to try to see what had happened. But by now it was night. There was no moon, and there was nothing to see but the dark. When we went back indoors, Bruno did not feel like talking anymore, and neither did I. We went to bed, but an hour later I heard him get up, throw wood into the stove, and pour himself a drink. Emerging from the burrow in the morning, we found ourselves in the light that follows prolonged snowfall. Behind us, the sun was shining, and the mountain in front of us dazzled the basin. We immediately saw what had happened. The main gorge of the Grenon, the one that Bruno had skied down just hours before, had discharged an avalanche that had started 300 or 400 meters further up, at the steepest point of the slope. On plunging down, the snow had dug deep into the ground, so much so as to strip the rock beneath and drag the earth and gravel down with it. The gorge looked like a dark wound now. Crashing into the basin after falling for 500 meters, the avalanche had gathered enough force to smash through the frozen surface of the lake. That must have been the second sound that we heard. Now, at the base of the gorge, there was nothing left of the lake's soft expanse, just a mass of dirty snow and blocks of ice, like a serac. The mountain crows were circling above and alighting within it. I could not work out what was attracting them there. It was a terrible and fascinating sight, and we did not need to say anything before going to take a closer look. The carrion that the crows were sharing was the corpses of dead fish. Small silver trout caught in the midst of their winter hibernation, flung out of the dense dark water in which they slept, up onto a bed of snow. Who knows whether they had time to be aware of what was happening. It must have been like a bomb exploding. From the upturned and shattered slabs I could see that the ice must have been 0.5 meter thick on the surface of the lake. Underneath, the water had already begun to freeze over again. This was only a thin layer as yet, dark but transparent, like the one I had seen in autumn. Some crows were squabbling over a trout nearby, and finding it at that moment an insufferable spectacle of greed, I scattered them with a couple of steps and a kick. All that was left behind on the snow was a pink mush. "Sky burial," said Bruno. "Have you seen anything like this before?" I asked. "No, I certainly haven't," he replied. He seemed impressed. I heard the sound of a helicopter approaching. There was not a cloud in the sky that morning. With the first warmth from the sun, clumps of snow began to fall from every overhang of Grenon, and from the guttering, small avalanches fell. It was as if the mountain were starting to free itself from that prolonged snowfall. The helicopter flew above without noticing us and passed on, and then it occurred to me that we were barely a few kilometers from the ski slopes on Monte Rosa on December 27, on a morning of sunshine and fresh snow. It was a perfect day for skiing. Perhaps they were watching the traffic from up there. I imagined from above the lines of cars, the overflowing car parks, the establishments working to full capacity without a break. And just there, over a nearby ridge, on the side that was in shadow, two men standing at the foot of a landslide surrounded by dead fish. "I'm going," I said, for the second time in just a few weeks. Twice I had tried, and twice I had failed to rescue him.
"Yes, it seems like the right thing to do," said Bruno.
"You should come down with me."
"Again?"
I looked at him.
Something had occurred to him that caused him to smile. He said, "How long have we been friends?" "I think that next year it will be 30 years."
"And haven't you been trying to get me down from here for the last 30 years?
Then he added, "You mustn't worry about me. This mountain has never done me any harm." I remember little else about that morning. I was shaken and too sad to think clearly. I remember that I could not wait to leave the lake and the avalanche behind me, but that later on, once I was down in the valley, I began to enjoy the descent. I found the route by which I'd come up, and discovered that with the snowshoes I could go down in great leaps, even at the steepest points, as the fresh snow did not give way beneath my feet. The steeper the incline, in fact, the more I could launch myself and let myself go. I stopped only once, when crossing the river, because I had thought of something and wanted to see if it was true. I climbed down between its snow-covered banks and dug in the snow with my gloves. Just below it I found the ice, a thin, transparent layer that broke easily. I discovered that this thin crust protected a vein of water. You could not see it or hear it from the path, but my river was still there, coursing beneath the snow. It turned out that in the winter of 2014, the Western Alps had the heaviest snow for half a century. In the highest ski resorts, they recorded 3 meters of snow at the end of December, 6 at the end of January, 8 by the end of February. Reading these figures in Nepal, I could hardly begin to imagine what 8 meters of snow would look like in the high mountains. It was enough to bury the woods, so much more than was needed to bury a house. One day in March, Laura wrote to me, asking me to phone her as soon as possible. She then told me that Bruno could not be found. His cousins had gone up to check on him, but at Barma nobody had been clearing the snow for some time. The little house had disappeared beneath it, and even the rock face was barely visible. The cousins had called for help, and a rescue team, taken up by helicopter, had dug down to the roof. They had made a hole in the tiles, and at that point had expected to find him, as sometimes happened with the old mountain folk, having taken to his bed with a sudden illness and died there of hypothermia. But there was no one in the house, nor could any tracks be found in the surrounding area after the recent snowfalls. Laura asked me if I had any ideas, since I had been the last one to see him, and I said that they should check if there was still a pair of skis in the storeroom. No, they were not there either. The mountain rescue team began to search the area with dogs, so for a week I called every day, hoping for news. But there was too much snow on the Grenon, and with spring, the worst period for avalanches arrived. In March, the Alps suffered many, and after the events of that winter, in which the death toll on the Italian mountainsides had reached 22, nobody took much interest in a local man lost from view in a deep valley above his own home. It hardly seemed necessary to Laura or to me to keep insisting that they should prolong the search. They would find Bruno with the first thaw. He would turn up in some gorge in the middle of the summer, and the crows would be the first to find him. "Do you think that this is what he wanted?" Laura asked me over the phone. "No, I don't think so," I lied.
"You managed to understand him, didn't you? You understood each other."
"I hope we did."
"Because it sometimes seems to me that I never knew him."
And then I asked myself, who was it that had known him on this earth except me? And if what was between us was kept secret, that which we had shared, what was left now that one of us was no longer there? When those days came to an end and the city became unbearable, I decided to take a tour in the mountains on my own. Spring is a wonderful season in the Himalayas. The green of the rice paddies dominates the sides of the valleys. A little above them, the rhododendrons are in flower. But I did not want to go back to a familiar place, or to retrace the path of any memory. So I chose a region where I had never been before, bought a map, and set off. I had not felt the joys of freedom and discovery for a long time now. I found myself leaving the trail, climbing up a hillside to reach a ridge just out of curiosity to see what was on the other side, lingering in a village without having planned to, spending a whole afternoon amidst the pools of a river. That was our way of being in the mountains, Bruno's and mine. I thought that would be a way of preserving our secret in the years to come.
It also came to mind that there was a house up there at Barma with a hole in its roof, and that it would not survive like that for very long. And I thought this as if from very far off. From my father I had learnt, long after I had stopped following him along the paths, that in certain lives there are mountains to which we may never return, that in lives like his and mine you cannot go back to the mountain that is at the center of all the rest, and at the beginning of your own story, and that wandering around the 8 mountains is all that remains for those who, like us, on the first and highest, have lost a friend. The 8 Mountains, a novel, was written by Paolo Cognetti, translated by Simon Cornell and Erica Segre, and read by Jacques Roy. Editing and post-production by Common Mode, Paul Fowley, Technical Director. This has been a presentation of Simon & Schuster Audio. The 8 Mountains, a novel, is available in print from Atria Books.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.